is the...
Oh, you want to identify
this,
the tape.
Okay. I'll say this is our part two of the interview with Lash LaRue, and today is December 13th, year 2000. When we were talking last time, you were commenting on the Ramparts article. I asked you about that. You want to talk a little bit more about that you remembered?
Well...
And the impact on campus.
Yeah. One of the most embarrassing disclosures in that, or exposés in that Ramparts article, was that Michigan State's project over there was operating in effect as a front for the CIA. And I've spent a lot of time trying to figure out how the CIA might have gotten involved. But first, I should point out, I came here in 1956, and the member of the econ department who took me around the campus was a fellow named John Hunter, long since retired now. But he had been in Vietnam as part of our project. We had two economists there while that project was operating. And so he told me a little bit about it, etc. And I can't remember whether it was John Hunter or some of the other people who had been there and come back, who talked about a mysterious group of about half a dozen people who were assigned to that project. Apparently they had a bullpen there with desks for various members of that project. And these people would come in, stake out a desk for themselves, put some material around the desk or something to show it was their desk, and then they'd leave and they'd never see them again, and they referred to them as spooks.
It's spooks.
Which is obviously a slang expression for secret service people or spies or whatever. And they were intrigued with the fact that these guys came, staked out a desk, left, never came back. And they suspected they were probably CIA agents, but they didn't push it, and they didn't know for sure whether they were or not. Well, it turned out they were. We did have some. Now, here's my understanding of how they got there. Not long after that institute was established, the opposition to the GM regime mounted. We called them Viet Cong, I always thought it was
the opposition.
It was the opposition. The Viet Cong apparently means Vietnamese communist. Well, some were and some weren't, you know, but there's a lot of opposition to GM. And so it occurred to people out there in the project that what was needed were some counterinsurgency experts. So they communicated that back here. Now, it just happened. This story is just full of coincidences, one of which I alluded to with respect to why Michigan State was chosen. It was because President Hanna had been an assistant secretary of defense, etc. Anyway, the head of police administration at that time was a guy named Art Brandstetter, who was a reserve general in the military police. And he had a lot of contacts in the Pentagon. So when the word came back to the campus that what they needed out there were some counterinsurgency experts, this was passed on to Brandstetter, who in turn got in touch with his friends in the Pentagon and told them of our need. They did the natural thing. They got in touch with the CIA, and they, I am assuming this, sort of like a novel, you know, told the, and then CIA people said, what a beautiful opportunity for us to infiltrate some people as adjunct professors or whatever at Michigan State University, part of this Institute for Public Administration. So the CIA fed these people into the stream of participants in that program out there. Now, I was at a dinner, I guess a month or so ago, where there were some people who had come to Michigan State long after that Ramparts article appeared, but somebody mentioned this. There was a group of maybe 10, which included former Vice President Milton Melder, Vice President for Research Development, I think, formerly in the History Department. So he was there, and somebody said, could one of you people who was around at the time explain how we got mixed up with the CIA and Vietnam. So I didn't realize Miller had anything to do with that project. I don't know that he did, but I waited for him as a sort of the senior person to explain it. He didn't say anything. I said, well, I'll offer my recollection of that. So I told the story the way I've told it here, and everything seemed perfectly logical to me. Logical that we would be chosen to do that. Logical that when we got word from out in the field, we needed some counterintelligence people. The Army would hear about it, they'd get in touch with the CIA. All that seemed perfectly natural to me. And I sort of took it as a joke, you know. Miller got furious to say that he was perturbed. Gross understatement. He said, that is absolutely wrong. He said, that's not correct at all. He said, there was never more than one person, one CIA person there. And he said, I went out to Vietnam as a representative of Michigan State to see how things were going. And when I discovered there was a CIA representative in that group, I came back and I told President Henry, we've got to get that CIA man out of there. And we did. Mm-hmm. I don't believe him for a moment. Mm. But that's his recollection of it.
Did you have any contact with Wesley Fischel or not? At that time? Did his name come up as your...
Oh, it came up all the time. Yeah. See, the SDS, some of the SDS people went into his classroom and harassed him. Mm-hmm. And I told him, cut that out. That, you know, that's really gross. You have no business disrupting somebody's classroom. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether they cut it out or not. I didn't monitor my injunction. Mm-hmm. But he was subjected to a lot of nasty criticism, mostly from students. Mm-hmm. A lot of the faculty didn't approve of his involvement in Vietnam, but they didn't say anything. They weren't unpleasant about it. But by coincidence, I had a locker in the gym right next to his locker. And I think it was more awkward for him than it was for me. I mean, he knew who I was. I'd never actually met him. Mm-hmm. But he knew that I was wound up with anti-Vietnam protests and probably an advisor to the SDS, that kind of thing. So we never exchanged a word. Mm-hmm. And I think I said hello to him, but I don't think he responded. Mm-hmm. He must have thought, my God, why did I wind up next to this guy? But you know, it was pathetic, and I shouldn't laugh about it, but he couldn't have been more than 45 at that time, I suppose. Mm-hmm. He was in absolutely perfect physical condition. He was a medium-sized person, but there wasn't an ounce of fat on him. He ran all the time, he exercised, and he died suddenly. I don't know what the cause was. Mm-hmm. He couldn't have been more than about 45 or so. Mm.
Wow.
Really, you know, a sad thing. Mm-hmm. He left here and went over for a year, I think it was, to Southern Illinois. People always said it was to get away from all this harassment he's subjected to here. Mm-hmm. But inevitably, the students over there discovered who he was, and they gave him a hard time over there, too. Mm-hmm. See, his life was miserable. I had students who took his course who would tell me that he would apologize so much. Well, not really apologize. Try to explain what he was doing over there. And he would pass around a photograph covering the attack, when one attack made on him, that he lived in a mansion. He said, no, look how modest this place is that I live in. I think he was also accused, and it seems reasonable that he probably did this, of having a car with, you know how a general will have a star flag
on
the fender? Mm-hmm. Well, he was accused, I think, of having a limousine chauffeur-driven. Mm-hmm. Well, he was very close to Jim. It probably did have a limousine. Mm-hmm. It'd be normal with a flag, you know, on the thing. And he did object to those stories, and he would explain to the students that they were grossly exaggerated.
It's interesting that the impact that people are still talking about and debating that article.
Still debating it, yeah.
And the impact of it.
Well, it was terribly embarrassing at the time. Mm-hmm. Now, another thought struck me as I was reflecting on last time. You asked about the grievance procedure. I don't know if you asked how did it come into being, or I just thought I would tell you without being asked. Mm-hmm. Well, see, here's the way I see that, and I want to tell about one more incident that contributed toward the sentiment which led the board to instruct the president to establish a grievance procedure. The first episode was Orange Horse 3, with a big furor, lots of coverage in the state news, and negative coverage in the state journal. We used to have a reporter named Helen Clegg, C-L-E-G-G, mm-hmm. who covered the campus for the state journal, and she apparently had a very intense hostility to Michigan State, because as I remember, she never wrote a story about Michigan State without getting a bunch of digs in. Mm-hmm. You know, what a wretched place it was. Mm-hmm. Maybe she was a Michigan grad. I never, never figured that out. But so the Orange Horse 3 got a lot of publicity, and some of it negative, on the grounds that they were being dismissed and couldn't find out why. Then came the Hildebrand case. That got a lot of publicity. And then there was an uproar in the natural science department growing out of the new people who were just about evenly in number to the people who were, had been here quite a while. Now, my recollection is that some of the people, at least, who had been here for some time had gotten jobs teaching this generalized natural science course, and they had master's degrees in some natural science area. And that seemed appropriate. Michigan State was just in the process of developing into a university when they were hired. And these people had prepared a textbook for the course. They'd written it themselves, and they all taught from this textbook. Well, these new people came in, and they had degrees in, had PhDs in physics and various natural science areas, and they looked down their noses at this textbook and didn't want to teach it. And so inevitably there was a lot of conflict between the, what I'll call the old guard, for a lack of a better term, mm-hmm. and the newcomers. It always came to a head when they started writing a constitution and bylaws for the department. So the time came when, this was 1969, a delegation, I think about five of the new natural science faculty, went over to see the president, who at that time was Adams, to ask him what could they do about this, because they didn't see, they kept being blocked by the old guard, I think that was their story, when it came to adopting some of these bylaws in the Constitution. So he told them, and he reported this to me. He said, well, it wouldn't be appropriate for me as president to mastermind or be a consultant for a revolution in your department, but I have a colleague who's a specialist in that.
So you were the colleague?
I was the colleague. So he sent him over to see me. And I did, in fact, consult with them on the way to go about what they were trying to do.
In an informal basis?
Well, I wasn't paid for it or anything. Mm-hmm, just, mm-hmm. You know, I consider that part of my teaching duties. Mm-hmm. Well, the time came when one of the faculty, a woman named Eileen Van Tassel, was told, you're not going to be reappointed. She was a leader, one of the leaders in this rebellion. And so I thought, by giving advice to this group, and then the upshot of it turns out to be she's told she's not being reappointed, I had an obligation to help her get reappointed somehow. So I don't remember how the way I went about that evolved, but the time came when I went to the trustees privately, and not all the trustees. There was one member of the board at that time named Claire White. He's dead now. He was a teacher economics in a high school up in Bay City. And he had tried to organize a branch of the AFT in the school where he was teaching, and he got fired for that. That was Michigan in the old days. So he went to, I think he went to the head of the CIO. The AFL wasn't much interested in helping teachers at that time. I don't know if there was an AFT local in Detroit or not. There's mm-hmm. a powerful local down there now. Anyway, I think he went to Gus Scholl, who was the head of the CIO in Michigan. And guess Scholl, I don't know how he did it, but he got him reinstated on the job. And I think that was probably not the only time he locked horns with the administrators, but it certainly reinforced his hostility to them. Mm-hmm. So he was a Democratic member of the board. There were five Democrats on the board at that time. And as I think I said the other time, they all owed their jobs to UAW's support. So I got in touch with him. I think I'd met him one time at some social gathering somehow. And I told him all about this, and he showed sympathetic interest. And so I got a lot of publicity connected with her denial of reappointment, too, in the state news and mm-hmm. to some extent in the state journal. So the time came when I went to him and I said, look, we started talking about how we ought to have a grievance procedure, and the board should lay down a rule that if somebody's being denied reappointment, that person's entitled to be given reasons why, in writing, if asked for. So they were discussing that. And even though there were five Democrats on the board owing their positions to the UAW, they were dragging their feet on this. But he and I would talk, and I'd say, you got to get moving, get that grievance procedure so some of these people who've been denied reappointment can file a grievance on that. Well, ultimately, he decided he would present a motion to the board under which the board would continue Van Tassel in her job for another year while we awaited the grievance procedure, which I think a committee was working on at the glacial pace you would expect in an academic committee. Not everybody in the faculty was all that excited about having a grievance procedure. You know, guys with tenure didn't see any need for it. Mm-hmm. So anyway, she got, by board action, she got one more year. Well, that year came and was almost gone, and we still didn't have a grievance procedure. We still, non-tenured people still didn't have a right to find out why they were being denied reappointment. So with great effort, contributed toward urging the board to give her another year. And so finally they did that. And there was a lot of grumbling on the faculty about that. Why they grumbled, I don't know. But I've been active in the American Civil Liberties Union, as I think I said last time, for 50 years now, right after World War II. And faculty members are not all that sensitive to civil liberties issues, even academic freedom questions. Mm-hmm. Most of them are not. So maybe that's why. But some of them thought that the board exceeded its authority or intruded into the affairs of the department, et cetera. And I think they assumed that the departments were well run, and most of them probably were. But I would have to, it would be my view that any department, no matter how well run, for the permanent members, which treats untenured people that way, is not well run. So I think I probably, I shouldn't say I, the people who supported her, whom I was one, rubbed some of these people the wrong way. I think I mentioned some people in social science mm-hmm. going to the, writing to the provost and complaining about my writing columns.
That was John Campbell, was the provost at that time?
Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah. I wrote one column, I don't know if it's in that Lashing Out, but I really was pleased with that one. There was an incident in Vietnam where you would see, if you were watching television, that a helicopter had landed. This wasn't when we were leaving Vietnam, it was before that, or maybe it was about that time. Anyway, this helicopter had landed, it was lifting off, and there were some Vietnamese desperately trying to come aboard, and they were hanging on the skids. Mm-hmm. It was reminiscent of the Hindenburg dirigible mm-hmm. in mm-hmm. Lyndhurst, New Jersey, that where people are hanging onto those ropes and you see them falling off. It's a poignant scene, you know, for these poor devils mm-hmm. hanging on the skids and then dropping off. So the title for the column was something hanging on the chopper's skids or something. It was about these untenured people being dropped mm-hmm. and desperately clinging to the, or trying to their jobs.
Interesting analogy. What was, Eileen Van Tassel, was she in University College? Was that
we had a department of University College.
Right.
Natural science.
Okay.
The natural science department.
Right. Within University College.
Yes. Within University
and College. And the American Thought and Language and the Orange Hearts incident was also under University College.
Yeah. Ed Collin was the dean at that time.
Okay.
Not a bad guy, but he reflected the policy and the philosophy of the administration, which was we don't give people reasons when we deny them reappointment. They'll know why. That didn't affect with them.
Well, was there a perception in the late 60s that University College was a hotbed of radicalism, or?
Well, it seemed to be. I mean, it's just to think. You've got a ruckus in ATL, you've got another ruckus in all this, giving us a bad name in social science, and then natural science. That'd be the last place I'd expect faculty uproar, natural science.
So you think the board saw a pattern there?
It might well have. Yeah.
And also the efforts to unionize the faculty.
But we had another incident which didn't get much publicity. But it always comes to mind, used to, when I would discuss with Adams the position of Michigan State during the Red Hunt days as compared with U of M. You know, some people got fired at U of M on the suspicion that they were Reds.
Mm-hmm.
One of whom was a Nobel laureate in economics, Lawrence Klein, who left the United States and lived in England for, I don't know, 15 years or so. I don't know whether he was a communist or not, but he finally came back. And Michigan finally apologized to those people that fired for that. So Adams would always say, look how much better Hannah handled that problem. And I would say, the difference is we didn't have a problem. There was one guy on the faculty who had been a member of the Communist Party. And when the HUAC got in touch with President Hannah and said, we're going to investigate Michigan State to see if there are any Reds on your faculty, Hannah announced in a meeting of the Senate if anybody on the faculty had been a member of the Communist Party or was presently, let him know and if he could help that person dealing with the House Un-American Activities Committee, he would, something like that. Well, there was a guy named Williams in the English department, long dead now, who had been a member of the party at one time, and he explained that to Hannah, and then told the committee there was one member of my faculty, or there is, who was a member of the Communist Party, but he isn't anymore. He's not sympathetic with the philosophy and practices, whatever they are, of the Communist Party. So we weren't touched by that, never had a hearing, or people from here weren't summoned before the committee, etc. But the first time I locked horns with Hannah, if that's an exaggeration of how important I was, but you remember the Berkeley free speech movement in 64?
Mm-hmm.
Well, in the spring of 65, President Hannah was addressing a town and gown group down in Lansing, and during the question period, somebody said to him, President Hannah, do you think Michigan State is likely to be the scene of student protests similar to what we've read about happening in Berkeley last year? Hannah said, no, he says, I'm not worried about that. He said, the FBI has warned us that there are three communist-trained agitators who are enrolled in Michigan State in order to stir up trouble, but we know who they are. And we keep an eye on them. Well, I read that, and I was absolutely furious. I thought, for God's sakes, here it is, 65. I would have thought all the fear of Reds everywhere had abated by that time. But in addition to that, when I asked myself, what students could he possibly have in mind? There were three students who were in the news on the campus quite frequently at that time, because they were the leaders of a little band of students, probably 50 at the outside, called the Committee for Student Rights. Now, get this, with respect to their program, and see whether you see Reds anywhere. One, they wanted the rules governing life in the dorms relaxed. a women student had to be in the dorm at 11 p.m. on school nights, and I think midnight on weekends. If she arrived after the witching hour, 11 o'clock during the week, she'd find the door of the dorm locked, and there was a house mother who would admit this student when she rang the bell, but take her name, and after that she came in late a couple of times, she'd be notified, you're suspended, indefinitely. Mm-hmm. In one case, the father of a young woman who came from Cleveland or somewhere came up here to ask, what does indefinitely mean? When's my daughter going to be readmitted? And the answer was, your daughter has had the ill fortune to associate with some other students who were goofing off all the time, drinking beer and whatnot, and over the last several terms, her grades have steadily gone down. Now, when those students who are create the temptation to party instead of study, when they're gone, she can come back. Well, the old man thought, my God, how long is that going to be? So he put her in some other school. But so they were objecting to that. Mm-hmm. And they also, in those days, a male student who went in for dinner in the dorm had to wear a tie and jacket. Mm-hmm. And they thought that was extreme or something. And I can't remember what other elements there were in their program, but it was all that kind of thing, which was a national development. It was going on all over the country at same time.
Liberalize the living conditions on campus.
See, we were guided by an expression that you don't hear anymore, but you heard it all the time in those days, in loco parentis. Mm-hmm. This university stands in the place of the parent and protects the student while under our care against temptation, the way mom and dad would if they were living at home. Mm-hmm. Not an unreasonable attitude in some ways, but not popular with the students.
Not with 18-year-olds.
So they got into trouble with the Committee for Student Rights because they would print up leaflets and announcements of meetings they would hold and so on. And there was a rule in the dorms that you couldn't distribute advertising material without permission from the dorm management. Well, when they were told you can't distribute these leaflets and whatnot, they come in late in the evening and slip them under the doors of the students. So they were apprehended doing that, told you've got to stop that. And they kept on doing it. So that seemed to be the catalyst which led to the crackdown against them. Well, one of these three people who led this organization was a student named Paul Schiff, who came from SCHIFF. I've often wondered if he was related to the publisher of the New York Post, I think it was, Dorothy Schiff, I seem to remember. Yeah. He came from New Rochelle, I think it was. He was a grad student in economics with a minor in history. So I think it was the summer of 65, he went over to enroll, and he was told, we can't issue any class cards until we're notified that it's all right to do that by Dr. Gordon Sabine. And so Schiff came over to our department. He talked to the director of graduate studies to try to find out why was he denied class cards. I think he had about a 3.5 average. And this guy didn't know, but whoever this guy was who headed the graduate studies, he didn't want to do anything about it, so he sent him to me. I was on the floor right above this other guy's office. So I don't know whether I smelled a rat or was just curiosity or what, but I figured I'll call I asked the director of graduate studies, is there any reason that you know about in the econ department which would lead to denying him class cards for the summer session? He said, no, he's a good student. But he has a minor in history. So I called over and I asked the head of that department, was Richard Sullivan back in those days. And he didn't know either. So then I got hold of my colleague, Bob Repus, from the labor school, the only person in labor school who was, in my experience, ever showed the slightest interest in civil liberties or academic freedom, but he was an absolute tiger when the case. I think it grew out of his hostility to authority. Anyway, I called him, and so we got together, and we decided we'll divide up people in the administration, and I'll call some, and he'll call some. Well, as it happened, my neighbor was Jake Neville. I mentioned him. He was provost at that time. We didn't socialize. The only time I ever saw him in the neighborhood was when we were cutting the grass, and we arrived at the same point. But he was my neighbor, so I said, I'll call Neville. And he had gotten his PhD in econ with us, anyway, before I got here. So I asked him, did he know of any reason why this had happened to Paul Schiff? And he said, no, he said, I don't. But he said, why are you interested in him? Well, I told him, and he said, look, he said, we suspend, I can't remember, there are several hundred students a year. How come you have an interest in him and not the rest? I said, well, if the rest of them came to me with kind of a problem, I'd have an interest in them. You might want to send some to me. Well, he said, there isn't anything that you can do about it. Anyway, he said, we as a group, the administrative group, spent some time discussing the Schiff case, and we decided as a group to suspend him, and you're bound by that. I said, how can I be bound by a decision I wasn't a party to? You got to be nuts. Well, so that we left it at that. See. So then.